The pharaoh Akhenaten ruled Egypt 3,500 years ago. He was a radical reformer and a visionary who seems modern and still captures imaginations today. The statues, the friezes, and the household objects that have been excavated from Thebes, where he started his reign, and from Amarna, the showcase city he built, tell a tremendous yarn. The big winter show at the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston combines extraordinarily beautiful artwork and intimate everyday objects from Akhenaten's reign. Curator Rita Fried took us on a tour of the show.
We just entered the exhibition now, and the first piece you see is inscribed for King Thutmose III, Egypt's greatest empire builder. But in reality, I could have put any piece here, because this represents what Egyptian art has always been and would be after Akhenaten as well. What it shows is the traditional image of kingship in ancient Egypt, a face that looks beyond us, not at us, idealizing, perfect, the way people wanted to be, broad shoulders, narrow waist, a torso with no extra flesh whatsoever. A monarch in the prime of his youth. Changes in religion and changes in the art form had already begun under Amenhotep III, Akhenaten's father. And you see a good example of that here. What you see here is that the king is fat. Never before have we seen a representation of the king of Egypt in a less than perfect body form. He's got swollen breasts and a great protruding belly, which he modestly hides under his garment and his clasped hands. So here, even within the reign of Amenhotep III, you see a trend toward naturalism. And we also see a trend toward the elevation of the sun god, known as Aten, to prominence, among other gods, but he still lavishes special attention on Aten. And it was Akhenaten, his son, who began life as Amenhotep IV, who makes Aten his sole god. Naturalism of Amenhotep III to something that's much beyond naturalism, almost into a fantasy world with Amenhotep IV, his son. And you see that in this colossal statue. Everything is elongated, stretched out. The eyes are narrow slits, and they project outward to catch the rays of the sun. The nose is elongated. The chin is pulled down. The face is gaunt. The upper torso is also gaunt. And if the bottom of the statue were preserved, we would see that he would have had hips that swelled out in the most voluptuous of ways. This represents Amenhotep IV, and it comes from one of four large temples that he built at Karnak, the traditional center of Egyptian religion of the New Kingdom, a great temple complex dedicated to the god Amun. Amarna, the city that Akhenaten built midway between Memphis and Thebes, the traditional centers, a city that he dedicated to Aten. This is the so-called family stela, and everything you need to know about Amarna art, Amarna religion, and also Amarna politics, you can learn from this piece. What you see on top is the sun disk, Aten, whose rays shine down on Akhenaten and Nefertiti and present them with life. The rays end in human hands, and the hands present the Ankh sign. It's an intimate moment in the life of the royal family, something that you really don't get before. You see that Akhenaten is kissing one of his daughters. Nefertiti, on the other hand, has two of them to worry about. And they're sitting comfortably, casually, rather than stiffly upright in their chairs. Something else that's interesting about this, if you look at Akhenaten's torso with its emaciated upper part and swollen belly, voluptuous hips, you see that it's virtually identical to Nefertiti's. There's a lot of gender ambiguity here, and that will carry throughout the Amarna period.
We're talking about the pharaoh Akhenaten this hour, the pharaoh who was succeeded and undone, in a sense, by King Tutankhamun, King Tut. Akhenaten was a radical in power in many dimensions. He moved his capital. He rewrote the religion. He changed the art of ancient Egypt. Connectionist, does he fit your image of ancient Egypt? Can you imagine him in any other society? Are we talking about Lenin, about Nehru, about Ataturk, about Ross Perot. 1-800-423-8255 makes the Akhenaten connection. Rita Fried, who's the curator of Ancient Egyptian, Nubian, and Near Eastern Art at the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston, is with us in the studio. Also on the line are James Allen, who's the curator of Egyptian Art at the Metropolitan Museum in New York, and Donald Redford, who's professor of Egyptian History and Language at Penn State, and has also been deep in the Akhenaten Temple project himself. Rita Fried, get us started here. I've seen enough of these images at that glorious show to feel I'd recognize Akhenaten with his elongated chin and nose and face on the street anywhere. And also just, I had this sense of the enormous beauty of all of this work. Is that why we're talking about Akhenaten, simply because the work is so beautiful?
I hope we're talking about him because all of Boston is talking about him because of the exhibition. The work is beautiful. The story is fascinating. And in its own way, as you point out, the story is timely. It's about one person who made a radical difference in society.
But again, in what comparisons come to your head? One man can make a difference, but who are we talking about here? Is this Mao? Is it whoever built, you know, Brasilia, the new capitals of the 20th century, like Chandigarh in India, which Nehru built? I mean, what does it take for a man to not only inherit all the instruments of government, but to change them all profoundly?
In Egypt, it actually took less than you think. And that's why the comparison is a difficult one. In Egypt, the pharaoh was God. The office of kingship was divine. And whatever pharaoh wanted, people did. They didn't question it because he was God. Things are a little different today. And I think all the negative connotations that we associate with at least some of the people that you mentioned, can we associate them with Akhenaten? Well, actually, we really don't know. What about the priests whose temples were closed when Akhenaten did away with the worship of their gods? Surely they weren't pleased. All the bureaucrats who were out of jobs because Akhenaten promoted his own people. Well, I think there are some similarities there. But in general, in Egypt, what we have is propaganda. What we have is what the pharaohs wanted us to know.
What do we have? I mean, we have these glorious stone sculptures, which are in many ways indestructible. What else? How deep is the record, particularly the written record of Akhenaten and Amarna?
In some ways it's amazingly deep. In some ways it's absolutely absent. We have, for example, 400 clay tablets written in cuneiform, the lingua franca of the day, that tell us about what was going on outside Egypt. But in reality, what was going on inside Amarna, inside the city Akhenaten built for Aten, we don't know a whole lot about. What we know about is what was recorded mostly in pictures on the walls of his temples and tombs. We don't really have history, and there are a lot of unanswered questions. We don't know, for example, what happened to Nefertiti, an icon as famous as Nefertiti. We don't really know what happened to all of his daughters. We know what happened to some of them. He had 6 daughters. We don't even know if he had sons. There's a lot of speculation that Tutankhamun, for example, might have been his son, but we don't know that for sure. Things as basic.
Do we know what he had in mind? For example, in the redesign of the look, the line, the humanity, there's almost this sort of Renaissance rediscovery of a living human figure in the art of Akhenaten. How much do we know he had thought about all that?
We don't know. We don't know. What we do know is that art and religion are connected, that in some way the religion is motivating this. There's been a lot of speculation that Akhenaten had a disease that made him actually look like that. That's certainly up in the air. But I think personally that he did these things to be noticed. You can't stand in front of the spectacular, colossal heads that are in the museum right now and not open your eyes wide and not really take notice of them. I think that especially when you're looking at something that has a 1,700-year tradition and you're radically departing from it, you do it to be noticed. These things were so shockingly different from what came before that they must have been done so that people would take notice.
So is the religion, and I'd like to enlist James Allen on that. James Allen at the Metropolitan Museum in New York. I too dimly remember what Sigmund Freud wrote about Akhenaten in his book on Moses and monotheism, but surely the banishing of all but one sun god was a great moment in human history. Why, James Allen? James Allen, are you with me? James Allen, are you there? We'll come back to it. Donald Redford is with us too, who's been deep in the Akhenaten Temple Project. Do you want to take a crack at the religious question, Donald Redford?
All right. Could you repeat it?
sorry about that. It's simply that the arrival at monotheism and the enormous simplification of at least the god system in Egypt under Akhenaten was a radical step.
Well, yes, it is. In retrospect, it certainly was. And part of the debate still centers, although I think we've gone beyond this, still centers upon whether it was a true monotheism. I believe it was. He says over and over again that his God is unique. Now, the phraseology he uses can be paralleled earlier, but nevertheless, he is so insistent on the singularity of his concept of the supernatural that I sit up and take notice, for one. Moreover, there are examples in his inscriptions and those of earlier times where his men have gone around and hacked out the sign indicating plurality of divinity.
James Allen, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Walk us through the significance of Akhenaten's monotheism.
The significance of his monotheism?
Yeah.
It's the first instance we have in Egyptian religion, and it's actually the first recorded instance we have in history, of someone whose concept of a single deity was intolerant of other concepts. The Egyptians, long before Akhenaten, had come to the realization that, as the Greeks say, there was actually a single form behind the many names of their gods. That is, there may be many gods, but they're all manifestations of one god. But this is a very tolerant view of monotheism. In Akhenaten's case, he was insisted on exclusivity. There is only one god. There are no other names. There are no other forms.
The instruction, in effect, of the Akhenaten show in Boston is that the one God was Akhenaten's God, that he was God, in effect, for everybody else in his reign.
Well, in a sense, yes, because his God is very abstract. Unlike the other gods, traditional gods of ancient Egypt, he could be prayed to, and we have the text of hymns to him and so forth. And we actually have some indication that private people did that. But unlike other Egyptian gods, there was no interaction. The god did not reciprocate by communicating in some way with his worshipers, only to Akhenaten, to no one else. So for everyone else, it was kind of a one-way street, and it cut them off from the kind of personal relationship that they had become used to with their divinities. And so as a substitute, Akhenaten, who divinized himself, became the most approachable form of God for the ancient Egyptians.
We're puzzling about the man himself and trying to put together the pieces. What kind of a man makes this kind of a radical redefinition of the whole system of divinity in as complex and old a society as Egypt's?
It depends on who you talk to. There have probably been more psycho-historical interpretations of Akhenaten than there have of any person in human history. Some people view him as a visionary. Some people view him as insane. What's clear is that we have, in the case of Akhenaten, the first recorded instance in human history of a revealed religion. That is, of someone who has a sudden sort of blinding insight into the nature of reality, and this becomes a driving force behind a new movement. We have this over and over again in human history. We have it in Christianity. We have it in Islam. We have it in Judaism. We have it in Nazism. We have it in communism, both in political and religious forms. But for the Akhenaten, it appears, or in the case of Akhenaten, it appears for the first time in human history. And I think that certainly there was a combination of motives behind what he did. But I think if you look at the texts and you look at what he's trying to say, in the end, the prime motive is an intellectual one, or even a spiritual one, not political, not economic.
James Allen, what are the texts we're talking about? And I ask it partly because when we generalize enormously about ancient Egypt, it seems that the texts are overwhelmed by the imagery compared, say, to the Homeric texts or the biblical texts, or what is the written record here? What is the scriptural evidence of what Akhenaten was up to in his religious reforms?
It's primarily, or 99%, inscriptions from the private tombs that were built at Amarna.
And what did they say?
And they are, in many cases, they're hymns. In some cases, they're sort of semi-biographical. But they will say things, for example, like, the king has taught me, and I will carry out what he says. So it's quite clear that this is an instruction that's coming down from the king himself, being promulgated, as if a prophet would promulgate a new religion to his followers. And they also say that the life is for the one that follows you and death is for the one that does not, which is, you can take both metaphorically, that is, any other view of reality is really doesn't have anything to do with what life is all about. Mm-hmm. But you can also take it literally, that is, that those people who didn't toe the line had a hard time.
Donald Redford, coming back to you and in your own Akhenaten temple project, we're trying to sort of piece together some notion of this man, and it's awkward because the models of this sort of role are all either religious visionaries or fascist devils. what do you make of the man? What was he up to in your view?
Well, I honestly don't think we know. I've tried to be empirical in my own research. And I wish we had more direct statements from the man himself. We have some fragments of texts which appear to be speeches delivered to assemblies, and we do have the Amarna letters, in which one major letter and a fragment of another have come to light from his own mouth, so that we can hear the man talk.
What's he saying?
Well, in one letter, he's fulminating against one of his regents up in Syria and threatening all sorts of dire things as penalties for his failure to do what the king says. He threatens him with fire, which is the normal penalty, to be burned alive for a rebel against the king, and things of this sort. And then at the end, he curiously lets him off the hook. And he has said earlier in the letter that I'm going to bring you to Egypt to answer charges. And then at the end he says, well, if you can't come this year, come next. Well, I'm getting the picture of a man who, I don't know, he sounds fierce to a certain extent. But one wonders whether he was interested to the degree that some of his forebears had been in the running of this by now quite large imperial sphere of influence. Where his religion is involved, that's a bit more difficult, because motivation always is being asked about, as you have, in fact. And we just lack the text that could fill us in on the why and the wherefore that he did this. I can perhaps chronicle the first 5 years quite well, but why he chose to do what he did at this time, I just don't know.
Between the excavations at Amarna and computer simulations, some of which I've seen, I wonder how confident is your grip on everyday life of ordinary citizens in Amarna under Akhenaten? Maybe starting with you, Donald Redford.
Yes, well, certainly since he had placed a ban on or interdicted a good amount of iconographic themes, the artists tend to fill in with a lot of scenes taken from life. So that we do see a lot of house scenes, in fact, with servants going about their duties and people doing various things in their various walks of life. And very often the Amarna art material is used in books on everyday life in ancient Egypt to fill in the gaps, in fact. I get the impression, certainly from having excavated his earliest temple at Karnak, that his he had interest, at least at the beginning of his reign, that we didn't suspect. One being the performance of a gigantic jubilee, which took place probably late in his third year, or spilling over into his fourth, a festival which was usually celebrated much later in life in a reign of an individual king. To celebrate it that early is very curious, and I don't think we know why. But one entire temple was given over in its decoration and undoubtedly its function to the performance of the major acts of this festival. Hmm. And an adjacent temple dedicated to his wife, who suddenly, in the material I've excavated at Karnak, and others have excavated too, leaps to prominence as a figure in her own right, purloining for her own use motifs in art that were once male. For example, groveling prisoners, now turned into female, head-smiting scenes in which the prisoner has his skull cracked. In this case, the queen doing it to a female prisoner. One of the intriguing aspects of this is this woman Nefertiti, who comes out of we don't know where and who disappears into we don't know where. Hmm. But while she's on the scene, she is at Karnak, certainly in the first 5 years, a major, major power.
You know, I like your word celebratory. There's a celebratory quality about the whole thing. It's nice to be reminded in this exhibition that ancient Egypt wasn't always ancient. This was a brand new town. It was very brightly decorated. It was, in effect, I mean, it was like one of these new Disney towns in Florida or something. Yeah, exactly. It was an Akhenaten theme park with a tremendous novelty and vitality, a kind of brassy, almost overdone, nouveau feeling about it. Rita Fried, does that touch your sense of everyday life in the place?
I think you portray it accurately. It was bright. It was vibrant. Interestingly enough, the day-to-day life of the common person, in terms of the objects he used, the furniture, his daily activities, was probably not a lot different at Amarna than it was in the more traditional, older centers. We know this from the objects, the furniture, the jewelry, glassware, all take advantage of the latest technology of the time, but are really in no way substantially different from what we have in other cities in Egypt and tombs, because that's where a lot of our daily life objects come from. However, in terms of what was new and different at Amarna, rather than watching processions of gods and celebrating the festivals of many gods, what the average citizen had was Akhenaten and Nefertiti, because they replaced the traditional gods. So Akhenaten and Nefertiti and probably some of their daughters parading around in their chariots up and down the royal road on a daily basis were probably the event of the day.
What is the Nefertiti story here? And is it a story about beauty, first of all, or power?
Probably both.
Yes.
What do we know about what Nefertiti really looked like? We have no idea. We have many different pictures of her, from the famous bust in Berlin to an elderly line Nefertiti to a young Nefertiti to a Nefertiti with a very strong, powerful face with high cheekbones. We have the Nefertiti as mother playing with her children, and as Don mentioned, we have Nefertiti as warrior smiting a female captive.
Donald Redford, who's your Nefertiti?
Who is my Nefertiti?
Well, who is this woman?
Well,
the Hillary Clinton of her time.
Yeah, right. I imagine, although, again, this is just guesswork, I imagine that she did belong to the extended royal family of the day and may have been from a cadet branch of that family. But who her parents were, I wouldn't want to hazard a guess. He seems to have married her fairly early in the reign, because the children begin to appear almost immediately. But what her final end was seems to be clouded in darkness. I don't know whether she outlived her husband or predeceased him. Some feel she did predecease him. But others took her place, of course, later on. Her eldest daughter seems to have taken her father's eye and appears in a position of some authority late in the reign. So she remains a mysterious figure. When we get to Amarna, the great prominence given to her in the first 5 years at Karnak seems to subside. And whether that means anything, I don't know. It's awfully hard, by the way, to interpret art politically, you know. I mean, we're making a big jump here.
How different is the representation of her beauty and her power from any of the other wives of the Amenhoteps, for example?
Well, to a certain extent, she parallels her mother-in-law, Queen Ti, who likewise in the earlier reign of Amenophis III seems to appear fairly frequently with her husband, and who did accept foreign correspondence from foreign potentates, which most Egyptian queens would not have done. Moreover, some of the motifs of a military nature in which queen does what a king would normally do are already found during the time of Queen Ti's.
Hold the thought. We're talking about the pharaoh Akhenaten and the beautiful remains of his rule at the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston. We're funded by the listeners of WBUR Boston and by the Graduate School of International Economics and Finance at Brandeis, offering an information session on all programs on February 3rd, 800-878-8866, and by Goldsmiths 3, creators of contemporary handcrafted jewelry and precious metals and rare gems. For the complete picture, goldsmiths3.com. From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Akhenaten connection. Around the pharaoh, a prodigious reformer in many dimensions in the middle of the 14th century B.C. in ancient Egypt. The phone's 1-800-423-8255. Rita Fried, who's the curator of this show, that's at the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston, on its way to Chicago and Los Angeles, is with us in the studio. James Allen is a curator of Egyptian art at the Metropolitan Museum in New York. Donald Redford, professor of Egyptian history and language at Penn State, and a leader in the Akhenaten Temple Project. We're talking about a pharaoh who changed the look of Egyptian art. He changed the design, all the design rules. He changed the worship under a single sun god, and he changed the politics of his country before all of his reforms were undone. 1-800-423-8255 makes the Akhenaten connection. Sarah is on the line. Welcome, Sarah.
Hello, Chris. As usual, a fascinating program.
Oh, thank you.
I have really two questions, and perhaps they'd want to take them one at a time. One, they're both concern the religion and the monotheism. I wonder if there is any time connection, if you could tell us, between Akhenaten and Moses. I'm not very good on history and dates.
James Allen, I think that's for you, really, the Moses and monotheism connection.
The problem with this is that what we know of Moses comes from the Bible, and what's in the Bible is not dated. And it's not certain that it took place at a single period. I'm talking about the Exodus and so forth. Well, at a single period of Egyptian history, because it was written down much later than the events that it's supposed to depict. So
I thought maybe that Moses had learned his, if it was time fit.
Yes, the problem is that some people say Moses lived before Akhenaten. Some people say he lived after. But the main point is that if you look at the monotheism that you have in the Bible and the monotheism that you have in the case of Akhenaten, they share only one thing in common, and that is their exclusivity.
Yes.
But they are entirely different gods. Moses' God is what is called a transcendent God. That is a God who exists above and beyond the universe, is not a part of the natural world. Akhenaten's God is light, which is a natural phenomenon and is part of the universe. That's entirely different.
I thank you. My other question is, it seems to me that I read somewhere that, I don't know if it's Akhenaten's prayer or some prayer that got into the Egyptian Book of the Dead, that is very like the Lord's Prayer. So this is another connection with the Judeo-Christian tradition that I've heard of. Have you ever heard such a thing?
James Allen.
That's me again.
Yeah.
No, there is nothing that corresponds to the Lord's Prayer. There are things in Egyptian literature that are very similar to parts of the Bible. For example, Book of Proverbs. There are some passages in Egyptian literature that certainly prefigure what we have in Book of Proverbs. But certainly nothing in the New Testament is anticipated by Egyptian literature at all.
Sarah, thank you for the question. I hope that answers it. 1-800-423-8255, the Akhenaten connection. Judy is on the line.
Oh, hi, Chris.
Welcome, Judy.
I just recently read a book called Nefertiti, and unfortunately I can't remember the author's name, but there was one interpretation in there given out of, since Aten was an androgynous god, that portrayals of Akhenaten and Nefertiti and were made to look more androgynous to represent the, you know, the aspects of the god. That's one comment, and then I had a question about was Amarna's more like the Waco of Egypt, or did this monotheism kind of travel out around the country, and if so, how?
I want Rita Fried to take the androgyny question first.
That's certainly one interpretation. It's certainly possible that that's why the figures look that way. Another possibility, of course, as I mentioned earlier, is that Akhenaten was actually afflicted with some disease, and people have suggested Marfan syndrome as the latest. And it's without the mummy, we really can't tell absolutely. Another possibility, again, is that it's the fertility aspect, the life-giving aspects of the sun that are represented in these voluptuous hips. And as we also discussed earlier, this idea of gender ambiguity, the idea of combining the sort of manly upper torso with voluptuous hips that are female, with Nefertiti participating in many traditional male roles, sitting with Akhenaten in affairs of state, even having direct symbols of kingship associated with her. There's certainly a lot of sharing here, and that could be also what is represented with the figures.
Judy, do you want to follow up on the androgyny question?
No.
And
explains it to me.
How about the spread of monotheism outside Amarna, which really bears on this whole question of what was done with Akhenaten's reforms after he was gone?
In terms of what the rest of the country was doing, we only have little pockets of information. We know that Aten, the god, was worshipped at Heliopolis, the great city of the sun that went back 1,700 years earlier than Amarna, and probably at Memphis as well, possibly at Thebes in very small ways. But in reality, it's very difficult for us to tell what exactly represents those 17 years outside of Amarna itself, without a cartouche or an absolute date. So we don't know just how widespread that religion was, or how widespread it was. As in terms of what happens afterwards, well, we know that this was not a popular religion in the sense of really spreading throughout the country and lasting, because absolute descendant of Akhenaten dies, the religion really dies as well. What we do, the period after Akhenaten's death is absolutely murky to us. There's a lot of speculation. It's possible that Queen Nefertiti becomes King Nefertiti and rules for a while. As we also mentioned, it's possible that his oldest daughter rules, possibly married to a sort of ephemeral man by the name of Smenkhare. But what we do know is that within a few years, a young king by the name of Tutankhaten comes to the throne, Where he comes from, we don't know, although, again, it's possible that he was the son of Akhenaten and Nefertiti. It's possible that he was the son of Akhenaten and a lesser wife, a woman by the name of Kia. It's possible that none of the above is true.
Donald Redford, what's your account of what happened after Akhenaten?
After? We're fortunate in that we have a couple of major inscriptions that come about a decade after Akhenaten's time, describing the condition of the land in which he left it. Hmm. And the discontinuity in the cult throughout the country is marked. Temples have been not closed, just abandoned. Their payroll has disbanded. Their courts are garbage heaps, and the whole country is in economic collapse and ruin. The army is going around extorting goods and services from peasants. There's no justice being done. Of course, that is the prelude to the king saying, I'm going to put this right. And so there is an edict of reform. But through all the slight propaganda aspect of this text, you can see, I think, a country that had been allowed in that 17-year period to go a little bit to ruin, certainly economically. I don't think his worship of a single god touched many people outside his own city of Amarna. In fact, for the first 5 years of the reign, we do have his own statement, in fact, that he has put an altar to his sun disk in every temple of the realm, right from the Mediterranean through into Nubia. But after the half decade is up and he moves to Amarna, there seems to be no further interest in these outlying branches of the cult, as it were. And so I get the impression that he has, in fact, closeted himself for the last 12 years of his reign in his new city. And while he may have gone abroad on progresses, nevertheless, he always came back and concentrated all his effort on this new dream city.
Donald Redford, stand by, please. 1-800-423-8255. The Akhenaten connection. Barbara is on the line.
Hello?
Hello, Barbara. Welcome.
Hi. A couple of comments, and first, I would like to tell you that I was actually at the exhibit yesterday, so this is quite timely. And I am a blind person, so in that space, everything's behind cases. But fortunately, the Museum of Fine Arts has a wonderful education department. Ellie Rubin there deals with access issues, and she was able to give me some plaster replicas, let me touch plaster replicas of things behind the cases. So I used those in, and also the audio tour to get a sense of what was behind them, which was really a very fun time.
Good for you and good for the museum. Yeah. Barbara, what impression did you get?
Well, it is very different from, I was cited for a lot of my life. So for me, it was different. I mean, I have seen images of Egyptian things, you know, in my earlier life. So that these were quite different and quite strikingly different from the things that I, you know, was able to touch, just facial shapes, you know, the large lips, the long chins, that kind of thing, than what I was used to thinking as typical Egyptian art of that period or of those, you know, millennia.
That's absolutely true.
Rita Fried.
And are you, I trust you also got a sense of just how sensitively modeled that material was, just how expressive it was through the very subtle touches of the artist's chisel.
Mm-hmm, definitely. And, you know, there were certainly pieces within the exhibit, you know, that it was, for instance, the head of Akhenaten's mother.
Mm-hmm.
That was quite amazing, the wooden head of her, and the size of that and the delicacy in which it was sculpted. Things like that, I could get a sense from the audio tour. I was also wandering around with somebody from the education office.
Barbara, did you solve the riddle of what this man was up to?
Well, what I think, I mean, this is just another speculation, but I do feel that with the monotheism, you know, you've touched on several theories as to why this happened. To me, I mean, this is just one more sort of a psychological issue, is was this guy just monomaniacal? And one way of getting all the attention placed on him was by having a singular deity, you know, the sun god, and being the only conduit to that deity, you know, off the planet would be through the pharaoh. There weren't other gods you know, that were vying for attention. And so that was just my thought on how that might be what it was.
James Allen, can you reduce it to that sort of power trip?
I don't think so. It's very, that is a possible interpretation. But to say that that's what happened, I think is very dangerous, because we simply don't have the evidence. It could be that this was a man that really was inspired by his vision of reality, in the same way that prophets throughout human history have been. It could be that he was monomaniacal and egoist of the worst caliber. We just don't know.
Barbara, I like your guesses. 1-800-423-8255 makes the Akhenaten connection. Jack is on the line from Cambridge.
Hi.
Hello, Jack.
I saw the exhibit recently, and actually picking off from the last comment, that was exactly some of the thoughts I had. If I'm not mistaken, I think it was mentioned that Amenhotep III had himself deified as a sun god. And if that's correct, if I'm off, then my question is meaningless. But if that's correct, is there any speculation on the sun basically accepting the deification or rejecting it and making that the only god and then himself as the messenger with it? Is it a family trip?
Who wants to answer that?
I can take that if you want.
James Allen, please.
And as a matter of fact, it's been pointed out that the relationship between Akhenaten and his god, which, by the way, is not the sun, it's not the sun disk, but it's the light that comes in the sun disk, as he quite clearly states, is very similar to, and in fact is modeled after, the relationship between Akhenaten and his father. And we have indications at the end of Amenhotep III's reign that Amenhotep III became sort of deified beyond the normal vision of what was applied to Egyptian kings, and kind of viewed as all gods rolled into one. There's a nice statue in the Luxor Museum that's kind of a very good statement of that, as a matter of fact. This could have in some way influenced the ideology, the iconography of Akhenaten's reign. But if you look at it, it's much more than that too. It's much more abstract, and it's much more developed than just sort of a father-son relationship.
Jack, does that help?
Thank you.
Thank you. Rita Fried, I don't think we've talked enough about the significance and the imagination, the reconception of a beauty, and specifically of the rendition of the human figure in this show.
Previously, that is, for the previous 1,700 years, artists had been told to do something in one way. Now, they're in one instance, they're being told to do it differently. They're being told by Akhenaten directly, at least according to one of his monuments in the exhibition. He's instructing them how to make the human figure. But in another way, it's as if the ties that bind them are being cut, and they're being given liberty to work as artists. We have figures in new positions. We have emotionalism seen for the first time, a tender glance exchanged between an older sister and her younger sibling, or a hand very delicately laid on her shoulder. We have things like right and left feet shown, that is, the toes of the near foot depicted, all five toes rather than just the big toe, which was traditional. Simple things like that. We have people sitting comfortably on their chairs, relaxing, slouching even. And there is a sense of reality. The way a garment wraps around the torso serves to reveal the curves in a new and different way.
There's one very voluptuous female figure with a gauzy, sheer, I don't know what to say, cloth of some sort, veil, that is a most extraordinary rendition of the figure and of the veil.
It is absolutely.
Do you know the one I mean?
I do. It's a wonderful torso from the Louvre, probably Nefertiti. And what's even more amazing about that is that it's made out of quartzite, which is very hard stone to carve. And yet the sculptors have carved it and made it come alive. The stone really dissolves into flesh, and that gauzy garment you can just touch.
How much of that artistic legacy lives after Akhenaten?
A certain amount does live, at least as long as his artists are still alive. Probably after Amarna was abandoned under Tutankhaten, who changed his name to Tutankhamun, of course, the artists went back to the traditional centers. Here you had a large trained group of artisans, and they went on to carve in many of the same ways, and we can see that in places like ancient Memphis and to a certain extent in ancient Thebes. Tutankhamun, of course, also restored the worship of Amun, the old god, but even in these representations of Amun, of which Tutankhamun probably authorized more than 100, you can still see that same fleshiness of the lower torso, the same pendant hanging belly that you get at Amarna, even in the very representation of Amun himself.
Donald Redford, I wonder what you think is the significance, you know, in the longer term for our understanding of beauty, Egyptians' understanding of beauty as a result of Akhenaten.
Again, the standards that he set up clearly operated and were appreciated, if at all, in the upper levels of society. And one wonders how, to what extent they penetrated much below that. There is that, in terms of the longevity of the style that we know as Amarna art, there is that very interesting twilight period for about 10 or 20 years after his death, when there seems to be a melding of this new radical style with the older art, especially in some of the Memphite tombs where the court relocated after they had abandoned Amarna. And that produced some of the most attractive art, I think, of the entire period. Bereft of the eccentricities of the early periods of Akhenaten's experimentation.
Are we going to learn more about Akhenaten, or are we going to be speculating forever, as we have been for this past hour, about the meaning of the remains we do have?
I think we're going to continue to learn more. The excavations at Amarna are continuing even as we speak. Others are looking for remains of the post-Amarna period in Thebes. I think that with all the excavation that's going on in Egypt today, there are tremendous possibilities of new evidence and reinterpretation of the old evidence.
James Allen, Donald Redford.
Yeah, I hope actually that Rita is right, because one of the problems with Amarna is that the evidence that we do have has been so raked over and so reinterpreted and theories built upon theories that we pretty much reached the limit of what we can wring out of what we have, and dramatic new insights into the period are not going to come, I don't think, without new evidence.
Donald Redford, what's the Akhenaten Temple Project going to teach us?
Well, I agree with Jim that Amarna is probably a lost cause, because much of the epigraphic material has been taken away and we'll never get it again. There's less than a fraction of 1% has been discovered there. But at Karnak, there still is a lot of material below ground. And I myself, 7 years ago, discovered a new inscription, so that the temples that he erected at Karnak were not wholly destroyed. Much of the masonry was recycled. And as we recover this recycled stuff, there's a very good possibility that we'll get a new text and new inscriptions. So I'm very sanguine about that.
Well, let's hope. In the meantime, what we have in Berlin, in Egypt, in Boston, on its way to Chicago and Los Angeles is absolutely stunning. Just sheer beauty, as well as an enormously interesting story. Thank you, Rita Fried, for the show and for sharing it with us. Rita Fried from the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston. Thank you, Donald Redford from Penn State.
Yep.
Thank you, James Allen from the Metropolitan Museum in New York. Connectionisters, if you're anywhere near Boston, the exhibit at the Museum of Fine Arts runs through February 6th, then on its way to Los Angeles, Chicago, and the Netherlands after that. Thanks for help today to George Hicks, Michael Garth, Ted Curry, Rebecca Smuckler, and Kim Bichari. Our website is theconnection.org. Our website producer is Jim Norris. The Connection is produced by Catherine Bidwell, Hitesh Hathi, John Holt, Amy McDonald, and Keith Shields. Our senior producer, our Nefertiti, is Mary McGrath. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston.
Good night. Cassettes of The Connection are available for $15, including shipping and handling. To order, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287.
Funded by the listeners of WBUR Boston and by Hutchins, Wheeler, and Dittmar, Counselors at Law, more than 150 years of dedication and service to its clients, and by Sunday River Ski Resort, featuring 8 interconnected mountains, 126 trails to explore, and an extensive snowmaking system, sundayriver.com. BRI. Public Radio International. From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.